America's American film's leading exponent of bad taste. Pink Flamingos and Polyester are his best-known films. In his autobiography, Shock Value, Waters wrote, "To me, bad taste is what entertainment is all about. I've always tried to please and satisfy an audience that thinks they've seen everything. I tried to force them to laugh at their own ability to still be shocked by something. I like to think I make American comedies," unquote. Bad Taste is the subject of one of Waters' most popular films, Pink Flamingos, which concerns two families vying for the title of the filthiest people alive. Drugs, murder, gore, mayhem, kinky sex, and depravity are found throughout Waters' early movies, like Mondo Trasho, Multiple Maniacs, and Desperate Living. They were all made for a few thousand dollars and were mostly shot in Waters' home, his parents' house, in the streets of his hometown, Baltimore. Waters has always said it was his ambition to make exploitation films for art houses, and his films have made it to the art houses, initially through the midnight movie circuit. Pink Flamingos was one of the first midnight movie phenomenons. It played at the TLA on South Street for years. In the Greenwich Village Quad Cinema, it ran for 2 years and then was revived for 47 weeks at the nearby Cinema Village. Waters recently made it into the ultimate art house, the Art Museum. In February, the Baltimore Museum of Art showed a retrospective of his films. For the opening, the mayor proclaimed it John Waters Day. Waters' latest film, Polyester, is the first film that he made that was distributed by a major studio, and it played at both art houses and major theater chains. It starred John Waters' regulars, Edie Massey, the nearly toothless thrift store owner, and Divine, the 300-pound drag queen who usually plays the leading lady in Waters' films. Instead of the depraved characters Waters usually creates for them in Polyester, Edie played a tennis-suited debutante and Divine, a beleaguered housewife, concerned that her teenagers are going astray. Divine's love interest in the film was Tab Hunter, who was just teamed up again with Divine in the movie Lust in the Dust, which marked the first time that one of Waters' regulars in a movie made it into a more or less mainstream film not directed by Waters. John Waters is in Philadelphia tonight to speak at a screening of Polyester and a new film about him. This film biography is called Divine Waters. It's a documentary that was produced for Italian television. It screens tonight. There's basically continuous showings of these movies today and tomorrow. John Waters will be there at 9 o'clock tonight at the TLA Cinema at 334 South Street. For screening information, you can call 922-1010. One final thing, John Waters can also be heard occasionally now on All Things Considered. In addition to his movie work, he is now reporting as well, both for magazines and for All Things Considered.
Hello.
Hi, John. Welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I'm interested in the comment that you've made that you always wanted to make exploitation movies for art houses. Why?
Well, I'd really love to see my films in real exploitation theaters, but they don't work very well there because they're jokes. We use the same components as exploitation films with sex and violence and all that kind of thing, but it's done tongue-in-cheek and it's exaggerated too much for that other audience. So basically, I've made a career of offending liberals because that's who come to my movies, and basically liberals are the easiest people to offend, I think, because they think everything's all right until it's in their life, and then they panic. So I'm trying to get people to laugh at things that they basically fear could happen to them.
So have you tried your movies at at porno houses?
No, at porno houses they really do terribly. Oh. Because if they're hardly erotic. I mean, maybe a few people might find it, but they have more problems than I would even imagine. Sometimes that we've played them, I'm trying to get them on 42nd Street now, where I think that they might work. But generally they do much better. In the classiest theater, it does the best. And they've played in drive-ins in the South, where they did okay, but usually in each city, the town would get upset because you could see it from the road, and there would be like car accidents and stuff. So the town usually complained, and they'd have to yank them out, which crushed me. I've always wanted to see my films in a drive-in, and they have played, but I've never actually witnessed it.
Do you think that your films can shock middle-class people so well because you come from a middle-class background yourself and you
yes.
know it so well?
Sure. But, you know, the word shock, I basically want you to laugh first. That's the main thing. But to laugh and be a little shocked that you're laughing at something that would be so horrible in real life.
What kind of exploitation movies do you like the most?
Well, you know, today there aren't that many good ones because Hollywood makes them and they cost $30 million, which takes all the fun out of it. I guess the best exploitation film of the year was the Terminator, I think. But, you know, they make a film like The Thing, the remake of that, which costs $20 million or something, and it's got gore and everything in it, but it's done too well. It's not funny anymore. I think the real exploitation films today are the TV issue movies. I think it's moved over in that. So I think it must be so terrible to be a teenager today, because as soon as you have a problem to drive your parents crazy, they explain it to your parents on TV and tell you it's okay.
What are some of your earlier favorite horror films or exploitation films?
Well, I liked the Russ Meyer films very much in the beginning, the Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. I like things that were obscure ones like Door-to-Door Maniac, which starred Johnny Cash, Kitten with a Whip with Anne Margaret. A lot of the big directors today started out with exploitation films. That is the easiest way to start because I always advise film students, whatever you do, don't make a personal little arty film as your first film because it will never get shown and you'll spend all your money and you won't get any of it back. If you want to get in the film business, do something that will end up in a theater, which is an exploitation film. It's the easiest and smartest way to start out. A funny one, though. I mean, I think there's nothing against that.
Is that one of the reasons why you broke so many taboos in your movies to get attention?
Sure. When you have $10,000, $5,000 to make a feature-length movie, you have to do something that the Hollywood studios will not or could not do. And that's what we did. You have to go way out on a limb because you've got to get people's attention, even if they hate it.
Here's one thing that surprises me. A lot of people whose aspiration is to make sensitive movies about human issues start off making exploitation films because it's their only way in.
And maybe they're ashamed of it.
Yeah, they frequently are ashamed of it. And you're really anxious to make exploitation movies, yet you haven't had any like big Hollywood exploitation films. Do you want to get into that?
Well, you know, I have nothing against Hollywood. I went out there to pitch some ideas to a studio. There was one book I read that I never wanted to make a movie that I didn't write, and I still basically don't. But there was one book, The Confederacy of Dunces, that I really loved, and I thought that it would have worked if I had done it. And I went to Hollywood. I had two meetings with it, and the movie, they listened to me. I mean, I didn't get it, but no one's gotten it. The movie hasn't been made because I think they wanted John Belushi for the part because it's about a fat man. I wanted Divine as a man to play it, which I don't think went over real well with them. But no, I have nothing against Hollywood movies. I like Hollywood movies. I would make one if I could do the movie I want. It doesn't matter. Today, most Hollywood movies aren't made in Hollywood anyway. It doesn't matter where the money comes from. I mean, you get a bigger salary if it's a Hollywood movie, certainly.
What do you think your status is now among, backers and producers?
Yeah. I know there was an issue recently in California Magazine. They said the 500 most important people in Hollywood, and I was one of them for not going along with it. You know, and I thought it was very ironic. I think the best sums it up, when I was trying to raise money for the sequel to Pink Flamingos, Columbia turned it down, and the guy said, "We think it's hysterical. We laughed out loud reading the script, but can you give us something that we can admit we like?" That sums up the reaction. Privately, they're all for it. They all know who I am. They all return my calls. But getting them to sign the check, they can't say they're stockholders. This is our new star, to Coca-Cola, who owns Columbia. You know, so you're dealing with all that. But I know that, and I recognize that, and I don't find that wrong, especially. I think I've been treated very fairly in my career. I mean, I'm certainly not bitter about any of it. I have no reason to be bitter. I make a living doing what I like doing.
Are there any movies that you're sure you wouldn't make if you were offered them, any kinds of movies?
Oh, sure. I've been offered, Porky's imitations and that kind of thing. But I figured I've worked too long to make a name for myself, even if it's a bad one, to give it all up to do that. I mean, I'm sure if I had wanted to sell out in that way, I could be making bad TV movies right now somewhere in Hollywood. But what's the point? I mean, if I want to do that, I'll just go get a straight job somewhere. It would be like, to me, it would have the same appeal.
You haven't made a movie since Polyester.
No, I was going to make the sequel to Pink Flamingos. We had a very, very hard time raising the money because it was crazier than Polyester and it cost twice as much. And then Edith Massey died last year and she had a huge part in it. And I really didn't think you could make the sequel to that movie without having Divine and Edie. You need all sequels that are successful have some of the main original people in it. So it's going to be a novel now. I think my agent is working on it, so I'm going to have my first novel. It's going to be the first novelization of a movie that never happened.
Do you have other screen ideas in the works?
Oh, yeah. I'm writing. I have about three ideas in my head. One's called Hatchet Face. I'm not going to really talk about it too much because find that I curse it. But yes, I have lots of ideas, and I'm going out to pitch them to some people in April. We'll see what happens.
Do you go out to Hollywood a lot? I mean, are you afraid that if you spend too much time there and actually get in with the producers, that you can end up with a gold chain around your neck?
Well, somehow. I'm doing an article for Rolling Stone called Why the John Waters Tourist Guide to Los Angeles. It's going to be great fun. I love Los Angeles and have a great time there. No, I don't feel that will happen. I think that, to be honest, if I ever wanted to move from Baltimore, I couldn't. It's become too much part of my career. That's what Fran Lebowitz told me. If I couldn't quit smoking if I wanted to. You know, once you get into something like that. I go to L.A. My film Pink Flamingos played there for 11 years in one theater at midnight. That was the record. You know, it just closed. So I go out there. I do this lecture thing around the country called An Evening with John Waters, which I've been doing a lot. And I do it in L.A. frequently. So I go out there. I also go there to murder trials because they have good ones there. It's really the best murder trial city in the country.
Well, we'll talk a little later about some of the work you've been doing in prisons. But if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with film director John Waters. You kind of got away from shock, didn't you?
Well, I didn't want to have to be topping myself. You know, you always have to, you start with that, but then you want to sort of modify it a little, not for money reasons, just because it would be dull to me to try to just top shock, 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 shock. I want to get you to laugh. That's always, even in the beginning, was the laughter I wanted first. I still like to shock. I mean, it's, but I don't want to do it easily. It's easy to shock somebody. It's harder to get them to laugh while they're being shocked, which is what I'm trying to do.
Well, I think one of the beauties of the film Polyester is that you have two characters, Edie Massey and Divine, who have established themselves as real freaks in your earlier movies, playing the roles of really conventional people.
Yeah, it was like a sneak attack to get people to come see your film that would never go to a midnight movie, would never see an X-rated movie. So that's why I wanted to do it that way, to sort of widen the audience, not for money reasons so much, because we had to spend a lot more money. I mean, I made more money on Pink Flamingos than I did on Polyester.
Has shock become less important to you now that you're older? Because
I think irony is the most important thing to me now.
Was shock more important when your parents were still a kind of force in your life?
My parents are still a force in my life in a not a bad way.
Well, I meant in terms of having some control over how you, their son,
when
lived.
When I started out, there was a lot of things you could not do in movies, so we did them. Now there isn't. There's no pun. That's why in Polyester there was no four-letter words, because it's such an easy laugh now. And there's no word you can't say in a movie. Then it couldn't. There's no punch left to it. The same way with gore, any of that stuff. It's been done. So there was really no taboos left. The only taboos left are things you don't want to do. There's racism is still a taboo, certainly. There still are taboos. But they're ones that are too much trouble for what they're worth. I mean, to get a cheap laugh that wouldn't be very witty or anything.
Well, a lot of your films, you said you wanted to get into the art houses with exploitation films, and you have through the midnight shows. What do you think of how midnight movies have affected the way people go to movies?
I think that midnight movies really aren't such a big deal anymore. I think most of my films don't play midnight. Now, they play regular hours. They come out of the closet, so to speak. I think midnight movies used to be a thing that, if you knew a movie was playing at midnight, you know it was going to be outrageous. It was going to be something different. But now so many movies are outrageous. Hollywood movies are midnight movies, the same subject matter. So that you can play a movie at regular hours and have much better, more people will come to see it, because many people at midnight would rather be in a bar. They'd rather be on a date. I don't like to go to the movies at midnight that much. I mean, I'm tired by then or out, you know, at a party or something. So I think the midnight phenomenon is pretty much over.
One of the things that happened at the midnight screenings was the audience participation with the movie, especially through like Rocky Horror.
More than mine, yes.
Yeah. Well, what do you think of that? Did you think that was...
I think it was a phenomena, certainly. I personally, when I go to a movie, don't feel like having someone throw rice in my hair. I'd rather watch the movie. That's why I saw Rocky Horror in Germany in English, when nobody could understand it, and sat there in stone silence the whole time so I could actually see the movie. But I get they're having fun from it. I think it's certainly a phenomenon that no one could have planned. It was not a calculated thing what happened with that film. The 20th Century Fox couldn't have thought that up and made it happen. I think they tried to do that with Mommy Dearest by planning in the press that people were bringing wire hangers and stuff. But I think that was paid people that worked at the studio, which never really caught on.
When you have a movie that plays the midnight shows for a long time, it really gets the label of cult film.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Well, I don't mind being known as a cult film. And I think if it was really a cult film, I think of Jim Jones or something. That's my idea of a cult film. if it was really a cult film, I could put a subliminal thing in there saying, send me $5, send me $5. That's how I'd like to see if it was really a cult film.
I've heard some people who make horror movies talk about their movies in the context of it having the same value as nightmares, that who knows exactly what that value is, but obviously we have nightmares for a reason. And
I like having nightmares sometimes.
Do you really?
Yeah. When I wake up, I think, God, what in my subconscious made this dream happen? And so I don't really dread nightmares. I kind of like them.
Well, you know, in a way I like nightmares too, and I know why, because it's like the expression, bang your head against the wall, feel better when you stop.
Yeah.
When I wake up, I feel, well, what a relief.
Yeah, or
life
or
isn't
I think,
that bad.
God, how did that come out of my psyche? You know what I mean? And because they're usually so bizarre. But I also think there's nothing more boring than people telling you about their dreams.
Well, do you think of your movies, though, as as serving some kind of like social function in the way that you could say a horror movie serves the function of,
no,
of a nightmare.
I wouldn't intellectualize it like that. I think that I'm trying to make funny movies. And the only thing different in all comedies is that my subject matter in real life probably isn't funny. But I'm not trying to change anything. But if everything was good and fair in America, I would have no subject matter. So it makes it sort of, if there's something you dread in life or that's so horrible that you can't change, if you finally all you can do is laugh at it, I don't think that's sick. I think that's healthy.
You were recently admitted into the Ultimate Art House, which is the art museum. The Baltimore Museum of Art gave a retrospective of your movies. It must have been really controversial in Baltimore to have your movies, which are considered the ultimate in sleaze, in the museum.
You know, that was the scary thing. It was not that controversial. It came out, they had Grandma Moses before me. And it was a three-day retrospective. I had a black tie opening. There was editorials in the paper saying how wonderful I was for the city. And I thought, wow, these are the same movies I was afraid of getting arrested of 10 years ago. I just think people change. And if you stick around long enough, they can't get rid of you, then they'll honor you. It was very flattering to me. I mean, the mayor proclaimed it John Waters Day, but I didn't find out till 9 o'clock at night, which if I had known earlier, I would have gotten up and, you know, been really eccentric, put the imperial margarine crown on, Kleenex boxes on my feet, and stomped around the apartment shouting out orders or something. it was made my parents very, very happy. Only they dreaded it a little bit, too, because they said, oh, my God, well, we really think it's great because it legitimizes everything that you've done to all our friends, that it's there. However, we're afraid that now they'll think it's safe to go see the movies.
And your parents haven't even
seen
them. I
saw my father signing an autograph, which is singed in my mind forever, that image.
let me read what the Baltimore Museum of Art put in its program to caution its patrons about what they were about to see if they chose to actually attend the screenings of your movies. It said, for filmgoers unfamiliar with the films of John Waters, it should be reported that some critics have described his work as sick, vile, stupid, and repulsive among their kinder adjectives. Waters himself has assigned his earlier films a self-imposed X rating. The museum and the film forum wish to advise their audience to take the self-imposed X rating seriously before deciding to attend. Do you think that scared away people or got more viewers?
No, I think that what it did, I mentioned that. I said, don't you think you should at least, put something in. I mean, suppose somebody comes that has no idea what it is, that's a museum member, and thinks it's a film about birds in Florida. And I think it served two purposes. One, it was a hype. It definitely was a gimmick, like you're not admitted till after the show starts. And secondly, for the few people that were undecided that their sensibilities might be flayed so much, you know. So I think it didn't bother me at all, you know. I mean, they asked me if I'd mind. I said, no, I thought maybe you should have done it in the first place.
Did they, were they careful about keeping out minors and
no.
things like that?
No, not at all. And the audience was incredibly mixed. It was people in torn Levi's and evening gowns. I mean, completely mixed, completely. It was actually a very, very nice night.
So it felt good to be there,
yes,
respectable?
Yes, sure. I mean, it was so ironic, and even the museum people Brenda Richardson had put it on, they knew that it was, they appreciated the irony as much as I did. So it was really, I mean, received very well in Baltimore. The only person that came out and griped about it was the censor lady that used to hassle me for years that has been fired. She's no longer a censor board. And she came through with flying colors. She said she couldn't believe a municipal museum was using tax money for this and stuff. And then she said that I was responsible for every rape and mugging in Baltimore, which I guess was fair enough. But then she said that I was responsible for the dead rats in her cellar. And the reporter said, you don't mean that. She said, yes, which I thought was I couldn't have written a better line myself.
Who is the censor lady?
Her name is Mary Avera.
But, I mean, what does the censor
lady
do?
She used to be, Maryland was the only state in the country that still had a censor board. And every film that showed Maryland, she had to watch. And she could cut stuff, and she gave me hell for years. I mean, I had big arguments with her every time. She hated movies. She knew nothing about movies. And she would sit there and yell things like, rear entry, in her microphone. I think, rear entry? I mean, I've never even heard that term. And, you know, and she said to me when she cut Pink Flamingo, she cut out sex but left in the end, which I found was a very odd community standard.
What do you think of the way films are censored? What's the procedure, first of all, when you submit a film for censorship?
Well, there is nowhere anymore we have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We
just have the rating system now,
yeah.
Right?
And that is not censorship. No, you could have a snuff film and they'd still give it an X. They're going to not say you can't show it. It used to be you gave her the film and she sat there and watched it. And she would say, I don't want this, I don't want this. And if you didn't agree with her, you took her to court, which I did. And it was easy to win.
Does it strike you as strange that people who are responsible for censoring films like that get to see more of them than anybody else?
Well, the thing that's the most ridiculous is they helped me. She was my best press agent. If you really want to stop a film, you don't mention it. You don't pay it any attention. When anytime they have pickets outside of a theater, that increases the box office, and you'd think that they would have figured that out by now. Tell people not to see something, and they'll pay any amount to see it.
Are you officially considered part of the Baltimore Renaissance now?
I don't know. You know, I keep wanting to do my own Baltimore tour and have an old beat-up tour bus that takes you to all the worst places in Baltimore now, because people are actually going on vacation in Baltimore now, which is really amazing to me. But there's still the good parts are still there, yes. I don't know if I'm part of the Baltimore Renaissance. I was certainly there way before that. They may try to include me in it in some. The mayor there is so wonderful. I mean, he's really eccentric. I mean, to make it John Waters Day. I mean, I think he has a great sense of humor.
Are you happy that there's the Baltimore Harbor Project and all the like revitalization that's been touted in the press?
Am I happy? I don't go to it, but I'm happy. It certainly brings money to the city. I mean, it's good for the city. The city no longer has an inferiority complex, which they did for about a decade.
My guest is John Waters, if you're just joining us. You've been working in the prisons lately.
Yeah.
As a teacher, really.
Well, the last 2 years, it basically grew out of my fascination with going to murder trials. It was the next logical step. That I basically, there's something in me where I need the company of murderers about once a week. Because it really fascinates me. And I'm not saying I approve of murder or anything like that. It's the one thing I like to figure out why people do things. I mean, I've always been interested in abnormal psychology, all that kind of thing. And so I knew a person that taught there as a living, and he brought me in as a guest teacher a few times, and I showed my films. And I really wanted to get a job there. I thought it would be interesting, and it was, of course, irony to get a paycheck from the state of Maryland to rehabilitate people by showing them my films. I thought was rather strange. So I went to talk to the warden, who was a woman who was belied the big bird cage and that kind of female prison warden. And she was at first concerned I wanted to make like a documentary exposing the prison. I think this is a good prison. I mean, they're under psychiatric care. They have to keep up or they're put back in the bad prisons. So she said yes. And it was a course where you get college credits and everything. So I went to the college who sponsored it, and they wanted me to do it. And I had a petition from a lot of the students that wanted this course to happen. So that's how it started. And I showed them all my films. My book, Shock Value, was required reading. I think it's the only college in the country that had my book as a textbook. And I got a lot out of it, and they got a lot out of it, I think. I don't think I was bad for them. I told them, look, everybody wants to murder somebody every once in a while, but don't do it. Draw it. Write a story about it. I said, these films are my crimes, only I get paid for it. And at first, they were kind of bewildered to hear that. But I don't think that's bad advice.
You've actually, in your films, I mean, they're comedies, yeah, but they are a lot about people who are desperate or who are criminals,
yeah,
who are performing really taboo or criminal, yeah, acts. What was it like for you to meet the real thing, to meet people who really were psychopaths or really are murderers and,
yeah,
rapists?
The difference is that they are much more normal. They look like a college class in any community, I think. They do not look, what's the expression,
banality of evil?
Yes,
yeah.
That is the thing that impressed me the most. That was very difficult to connect the faces of some of these people who I liked, genuinely liked as people, to the horror that they must have caused other people. But once they're in prison, they're very different from maybe how they were when they committed their crimes. I would say half of all the people I had were always Vietnam veterans, which was many of them, Angel Dust was involved. Those were the two most common denominators of the people I had. This prison, though, is not for career criminals. It's people that are emotionally disturbed but not legally insane. So maybe most of them had no record and then one day killed three people. Or, I mean, the stories were amazing. But I told them I wouldn't exploit them. And in my article in American Film about it, I don't tell anything of what happened to them. Because I thought that would be unfair. I mean, to go in, and they confided in me and told me all. I was like, in a way, a therapist, only I had no say if they got out or not, which their therapist did. It was a very interesting experience for me. I mean, but there was humor always involved, and we talked a lot about that. In the most desperate, horrible situations, you can still laugh. And I don't mean laugh at what you did, but see the humor in these horrible situations. I mean, I went to the graduation where they wore caps and gowns and afterwards went back to a life sentence. What could that feel like?
Well, I was thinking that instead of you reforming them, so to speak, that they might reform you in that some of the things that you've kidded about in your movies might seem much more a serious, and that you might, it might be more difficult to make a comedy about.
No, I think it would have been easier
about criminals or electrocution in the future.
Well, I showed that film in there, Female Trouble, and they were very eerily quiet when Devine got the electric chair. Certainly, but no, I think that they brought out humor that I might not have had before. I mean, I took it seriously. Certainly, I didn't go in there with a light attitude about the whole thing, because I talked to the main psychiatrist there, who was at first worried that my sense of humor might be bad for their therapy, and I know what he meant. I mean, because I got a letter from one of them smuggled in a hideous account of rape that he'd written, and I, you know, certainly didn't encourage that. I wrote back, you know, some fantasies are better left unfulfilled. I mean, I didn't want to encourage anything. And one of them would say, who's your favorite new murderer? Which did make me laugh in a way, but I would downplay that whole thing. I don't know. I genuinely like some of them. One of them accused me of, he said, you only like us because we're criminals. And I said, that's a very good point, because in a way, most of them I like. A few, the only thing interesting about them was what they had done wrong. I wouldn't probably like them in real life. And interestingly enough, the most talented one sometimes I wouldn't let out if it was up to me to decide who to let out and who not to let out.
Did you get the same reactions from the criminals in prison who you showed the films to that you do from midnight movies?
Yes, very much the same.
Yeah.
Very much the same. Of course, any scene that involved lawyers, police, anything like that, they laughed harder because, I mean, it was so much in their life.
There's a lot of people who believe in a lot of sociologists who say that showing violent movies encourages people to be violent. And that showing movies about crime might encourage people to commit them.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that, having worked with
We talked about that. You'd be surprised at the films they show in prison. I mean, they show sometimes hardcore pornography, which shocked me. We talked about that. We had a whole class about that. I don't think my films are what they mean, because they're comedies. But we're talking about things like maybe the Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something like that. And some of them said that some of the people that were really violent psychopaths would watch them the same way someone would watch pornography, to be turned on by them. And that is a question there's no answer to. I agree. But if you – then nobody can see those movies because one person reacts like that. I don't think that's fair either. I mean, he can get turned on by that from turning on television too. These people, some of them, when they saw the films, they acted just like my parents. They were very straight. They would say, why would you make a movie like that? But in the same way, I think they figured if I could make a living doing this on the streets, there was hope for all of them, I think, in the long run.
Did you try to make follow-up assignments to the screenings of your film?
Oh, yes. I gave them, we watched Desperate Living, and then I said, okay, since you're under therapy, your assignment is you're the doctor, and you write a paper how to cure my characters. Then one time I told him, okay, on video, you play the opposite of yourself, which was very weird to see what they'd come up with. And, I mean, how would you come play the opposite of yourself? That really tells you a lot about somebody.
Your movies also have a lot of, there's drag queens and gay sex in it. And I was wondering how that went
the
over
sexual
in
thing
the male
in prison.
Prison.
This prison, when we were given teacher orientation, they told us homosexuality is not discouraged in this prison because sometimes it's the first loving relationship they ever had. That's a very liberal prison to say that. I was amazed they said that. The general attitude was like anywhere. It was something that, I don't know, I had nobody I knew in my class that were lovers or anything, you know. I think the attitude was, you don't talk about it. When the lights go down, it's your own business. What happens? The funniest thing I did see was at Christmas, someone had wittily hung mistletoe over the communal bathroom door, which made me laugh right out loud. That's a sense of humor, I think.
So there weren't, as there are sometimes in movie theaters, like little gasps from especially men in the audience when they see that some kind of homosexual.
Oh, yes. But it was so beyond that. It wasn't just homosexuality. It was the drag queens were like killers or psychopaths. I mean, it was beyond just the normal bad reaction to homosexuality. It was that homophiles would have. I'm sure there was some of that, and they talked about that. But we had one improvisation where one guy said, well, I've got to put my costume on. This really big kind of con prisoner, and he came back in full drag, and people went crazy laughing. I mean, this prison at one time was going to have, and I don't know if she came, a ballet teacher to teach murderers ballet to get rid of some of that macho, which I thought was a brilliant idea. And the sight of murderers plieing around the gym, I think, is amazing to me. But that's some of their main problem. It's just that they're so have to be this macho thing. And I think that my film certainly they were confused by it so much sometimes that that was not an issue even anymore.
Whoever would have thought that your films would be used in a therapeutic, rehabilitative context?
Well, in a way, you think of it, the Pink Flamingos, if that can freak out society's outlaws, where that humor was more dangerous to them than the hideous things they did with guns and everything, that they could freak out people that did that maybe isn't bad. Because they realized that you could use something like that to be antisocial, but it's not going to hurt anybody.
So do you see yourself as socially redeeming now?
Only in jail in a weird kind of way. I didn't go in there for that reason, but I don't think I was bad for them in the long run.
Did the prisoners try to shock you?
Sometimes at first, but then no. By the thing about who's your favorite numerous. Some of them would tell me their stories, and they were pretty shocking. But I acted like, after a while, you aren't shocked by it because they're all in there for something hideous. I don't think that one guy did. He told me about how he burned down house, did all this stuff. And then I just wouldn't react and say, well, did you get arrested for arson too? I said to him, you know, just like a normal question. And so, no, they after a while, they didn't.
Did they test you initially when you came in to see how if you were capable of handling them and understanding them?
At first, they knew I was coming. And because they had been set up from the other teachers, said this guy's going to come in, he makes these movies, and I'm in the paper a lot in Baltimore. So they vaguely had heard of me or something. They were all, I think, incredibly friendly. It was a chance for them to have a course that was certainly not like any other course they had there. We showed them other movies beside my movies. Showed Fat City, Wise Blood, Freaks, Streetcar Named Desire. So I think that they were very appreciative that the prison was allowing this class to happen in the first place. So they didn't try to test me. And if they did, I think I could handle that all right, enough so they wouldn't try it again. I was never frightened in there, certainly. I was more frightened of the guards, to be honest.
You know, I should say that one way in a situation like that of asserting yourself is to be kind of like naturally big and brawny and so that your body says, touch me and you're through.
No, I wore ties in there. I wore outfits. I mean, fop outfits almost, you know. they always wanted to try on what I had on and put on sunglasses. They always look for what you had on and wanted to put your scarf on or something, you know, in a weird kind of way.
You're also, you can be strange looking, but you're not tough looking in that respect. I mean,
yeah.
you're not very tall. You're slender.
Yeah,
you don't look like a muscle man.
No. There was one thing in my article that made me laugh. The first day I was leaving, you know, and we're walking through this really kind of scary, like, hallway with people, ping pong tables and everything. And I heard somebody say, well, somebody's got some sugar in him. And I thought, well, there goes feeling like Johnny Cash live at Folsom Prison. But that issue was never really a major thing. When we did improv sometimes, I said to him, okay, you play... You're meeting your long-lost sister you haven't seen for 20 years, only she's had a sex change into a man. And then some of them might say, okay, you have to play a woman. And they didn't bat an eye, really. I mean, believe me, they're under so much therapy in there that they almost would talk therapeutically about everything.
Was it depressing to spend a lot of time
in
prison?
No, it was not at all depressing to me. If I had to do it every day, I thought about that. If I went in there every day and that was my job, maybe. This was once a week. I look forward to it. I miss it. You know, I went back last week as a substitute teacher.
Did you ever think that if you turned out differently that you might have been in prison?
No, that's the whole reason the whole thing obsesses me is because I could have been in there. I think that there was certainly a possibility that in my life I could have ended up in jail if I didn't have an outlet for the rage that the films gave me. Because everybody needs that outlet, and they didn't have one. And I think rage is certainly healthy. I don't think it's bad. And everybody has it, or else they're pretty dull. People that have no rage, I think, are usually milquetoast personalities.
If you had so much rage, do you know what it was from?
Well, you know, I went to a psychiatrist for 3 years, so I've certainly delved into that and everything. And I don't think it was a bad experience. I think I learned from it. What it was from was probably that whenever I was born like in the baby boom and everything. So in the 50s, people were so relieved the war was over and everything. They all wanted to be exactly like everybody else. All our parents, my idea of my parents really, I think, was to be the Leave It to Beaver family. That's what they thought they were striving for. They were brainwashed into that by the culture and everything at the time. So probably rebelling against this predestined thing you were supposed to be. I think that brought the rage, probably.
When did you realize that you were going to be different from your family expectations?
From the very beginning, you know, because when I was younger, I was always interested in the things you weren't supposed to be interested in. And but I didn't have a rough time in school or anything. It wasn't a trauma for me or anything, but I just didn't care about it very much. I mean, school was a waste of time for me. I think for some people it's very good. For me, I went to a very good grade school, and then I went to public school, which I love because I went to this private school in the beginning. And then I went to public school, and I saw girls with beehives that fought and had rat tail combs and set hairspray on fire. And I thought, oh, my God, look at these. And I based a lot of characters on that. And then I went to Catholic school for high school, which was horrible. So I had all three types of education, private, public, and Catholic.
Were there books and movies that were banned?
That's how I started going to them. Yeah. Well, see, I went to private grade school, so they only got you once a week on Sunday school, and they really had to brainwash you then. And so they would say, if you see these movies, you'll go to hell. And I had never heard. I was 8 years old. I hadn't heard of Naked is the Night, Love is My Profession, The Bed, Mom and Dad. They'd read to us. And it was really thrilling when you first heard about sex to see a nun say, The Bed, in this really filthy kind of way. So I would seek them out and go see them. So I had the exact opposite reaction of what they wanted.
It became like the preferred reading.
Yes, and I used to, in grade school, in sixth grade, I remember sit there and redesign shocking ad campaigns for those movies that I heard about. And that's how I draw on everything. And I remember once the teacher found them, and he looked at it and just didn't know what to say and handed it back to me. He didn't make a big deal of it because he did not know what to say.
Did you like any of the movies that are made for children and children are supposed
yes.
to love them?
I love Walt Disney movies. I went to see Baby yesterday hoping for a Walt Disney movie. I was disappointed. But yeah, The Wizard of Oz is still my favorite movie. I love Cinderella. I like Walt Disney is really my favorite production company because they had the best villains. And I think I'd like to make a kid's movie even. I mean, I like children. I have a birthday party every year for this child that I've had for many years, and we show like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and all these outrageous movies. But these kids have grown up with me. They've seen my films being made, so they're not badly influenced by it.
Well, you know, a lot of parents are terrified of their children being exposed to violence in movies, demonic figures in
movies.
They're
the same kind of parents that go to Chinese restaurants and say, please don't put any MGB or whatever that stuff is in the food. You know, I don't know. I think that's overreacting. I mean, there's violence in the world. You might as well get used to it. What are you going to be raised so that you never know there's such a thing?
You went to NYU Film School, right, and got thrown
out
pretty
minutes.
Quickly.
Yeah.
Why were you thrown out?
Well, this was for marijuana, but this was in like 64, and it was then thought of as, no, 65, as like this really big deal. I mean, I don't even smoke marijuana now. I hate the smell of it. But then I did. I think taking drugs in the 60s was a different attitude. You didn't do it to wipe your mind out, which is what kids do now. You did it. It was a great way to rebel. It was like a secret society to smoke pot then. It was not in the news. I mean, if people heard you smoke pot, it was like, what? It was like the most horrible thing you could imagine. But I don't regret, you know, not going to school or anything. I mean, I think that was, I didn't try. It wasn't the school's fault. But they wanted us to watch Potemkin and all that stuff. And I wanted to see the Russ Meyer movies, and the Swedish films were the big thing at the time. You know, I, a Woman and My Sister, My Love. And that's the kind of stuff I was interested in. And then in film school, if you had an interest in that kind of movie, it was really thought of as terrible. It was really discouraged. This was trash. You can, and I think that's ridiculous. I think in film school, they should watch those low-budget exploitation films because that's something the students can do right in the beginning.
Do you now wish that you had gone to film school so that you could have learned more technique and made connections?
To be honest, I wish I had quit school when I was 16. I think I probably would have made at least one other movie. It would have been terrible. But that's how I learned, was from making them. And I still am learning from making them. But that's how you really learn, when it's your own money. And if something goes wrong, you remember, believe me, not after you write a paper, what it would be like to walk down the Odessa steps.
You were probably eligible for the draft during
that was easy to get out of at the time. You know, I just went in and told him that I was gay, what my bed was, a heroin addict, every single thing. And I went out, and the guy said, is this true? And looked at me with such disgust, like a Beetle Bailey type, you know. And I said, oh, yes, yes. And they sent me home. I didn't even have to take any of the stuff. I was there about 40 minutes.
And that was that?
Yeah. Like, I'll never forget, my mother said, oh, I'm sorry you won't be able to see Europe. I said, see Europe? Hardly in the back of, I couldn't believe she said that. She denies it to this day, but she did say that. It was hardly the way I wanted to see Europe.
My guest is film director John Waters. When did you get your first camera?
When I was about 16, my grandmother gave me this little Brownie movie camera, and I made a movie on it. It was called Hag in a Black Leather Jacket. It was terrible. It was all edited. I didn't even know how to edit a movie. I didn't know what editing was.
So you didn't edit it at all?
No, I just came out of the camera and I showed it in a coffee house once, in a beatnik coffee house, because in that period I was in my beatnik period then.
Well, you know, actually, you started making all your shocking, taboo-breaking comedies at a time when the attitude was more towards solemnity and peace
and rejoicing yeah.
and we are one. So,
see, I didn't want to sit in the mud with Earth mothers and their illegitimate children listening to Joan Baez. That was not my idea of a great time, which is what everybody wanted to do then. So, but you see, when I said earlier, making a career of offending liberals, we still did that then. We made Multiple Maniacs, which glorified violence. It was the exact opposite of the hippie thing. Even though we were in that life, I mean, we had long hair, all that kind of stuff. But I don't know. I mean, it worked then. It was the same kind of thing. And it wasn't a calculated thing. It wasn't something I sat down and planned out. It was just sort of how this group of people I was with felt at the time. That it was hypocritical to be a love child. I mean, come on. It just doesn't work that way.
Did Andy Warhol inspire you in when you gathered together a circle of your friends who became the regulars in your movies?
In a way,
certainly had
yes.
That in his.
I think the underground films that really inspired me were the films of George and Mike Kuchar, which they made these crazy movies in Co-op City, movies like Sins of the Fleshapods and Hold Me While I'm Naked, which were lurid kind of 8mm movies. And the early Kenneth Anger movies, Scorpio Rising. And the early Warhol, yes, especially that he could make movies that cost nothing. That was the main thing. You could use your friends and you could make these movies. Yes, it did influence me. Although Andy made, which I like those films very, very much, but they were almost more documentary. They were those people being themselves on film, where I always kind of wanted to have scripts and make it more of a narrative kind of thing.
The film that first got you a lot of national attention was Pink Flamingos. Yeah. How did you come up with the idea for that, of making a movie about two families?
I was driving across the country with David Lockery, and I kept seeing trailer parks. And that's how it came to me. I thought, what's it like to live in a trailer park? And they had Pink Flamingos in front of them. And we all at that time loved that kind of 50s kind of, and it wasn't the look then, certainly. And we liked that kind of Jane Mansfield, all that kind of stuff. So that's how the idea came, just like the filthiest person alive. You know, I don't remember where that came from. I knew that it was a war between two groups of people, and it just sort of happened from that, from seeing these trailer parks.
That and most of your early movies were shot on location, either in an abandoned area
yeah.
or on the streets. Did you ever get hassled by other
yes.
residents of the city or police?
We were arrested,
for
all of us, for conspiracy to commit indecent exposure while we were making Mondo Trasho. And the whole thing was ridiculous. Divine escaped in a two-piece gold lamé outfit driving a 59 red Eldorado convertible, which doesn't say much for the police. They couldn't find Divine. We all got arrested. We had a trial. We got off. The Civil Liberties Union handled it. And the judge read us a poem when he let us off, "Go Behind the Door and Sin No More." I mean, it was absolutely crazy.
Was it easier to get off raps like that because you were from a middle-class background?
I think when they arrested us, they thought we were making a porno movie. That's what they thought. And then when this happened, when I told them the title was Mondo Trasho, they thought, what? And, you know, and then some of the press had already written it, so they knew what it was. And it turned into a giant joke on all sides.
Two of the people who you've worked with a lot are Divine, who's
mm-hmm.
a really big man who plays the leading lady in all
yeah.
your movies, and the late Edie Massey.
Yeah.
Did it ever seem like the joke was on them, especially on Edie, who...
I know
what... Here's what I'm asking, that they're both really heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And in your movies would appear in really revealing clothes that would accentuate every fold in the flesh that would hang over
yeah.
over their stomachs and thighs and rears. And you could interpret it as kind of making fun of their size.
I don't think I was. I really like people that society has branded as outsiders who turn what they're discriminated against into a militant style. And that's why the whole image of Divine came up. A person that is fat does not usually wear skin-tight cocktail dresses. With Edie, only in one movie was she dressed really like that, in Female Trouble, in her black leather suit. Edie, I think you could always tell in the films, I liked her. You know, and I did like Edie. I never thought I was making fun of Edie. I think Edie was a very gifted comedian in her own wacky kind of way. I don't think anybody could imitate her. I think she was like nobody else. She had a delivery that was like nobody else, and she had a voice like nobody else. Edith certainly was made to look grotesque sometimes, yes. But I think that you liked her still. I don't think that you were laughing at her. I hope not.
So you see it as different than, say, Fellini's use of grotesques in his movies.
I think Fellini loves his grotesques, too, though. Have you seen this book, Fellini Faces? It's just all the people that have sent him resumes through the years, and it's unbelievable. I think he respects those people. I certainly do. I think that I don't want to look like that, I'll be honest. But, you know, Divine just lost 92 pounds. I'm so afraid he's going to end up real skinny, and we'll have to make the Karen Carpenter story. That'll be the only movie we can make.
Have you ever felt really alienated or like a grotesque? I mean, do you identify with people who were really on the fringe?
I respect those people. Yes, I'm fascinated by those people. And sometimes the things I'm fascinated with, I am attracted and repelled by at the same time.
I can understand that kind of feeling.
That you think, oh, my God. I mean, when I see some people on the street, I think, how could they walk around looking like that and not realize how grotesque they look? But at the same time, I sort of respect them for it obviously means very much to them to look like that. And I try to figure out why and what it gives them a satisfaction that I'm still searching to find out why.
Have you ever walked up to someone in the street and said, what a face you have to be in my next
movie?
Yes,
I've said to people, I love your hairdo or something, when they have an outrageous beehive in 1980. And they always are very, very flattered. And I mean, I do like it. Maybe for a different reason, because to me it looks so bizarre. But those kind of people are the ones that think they look really normal and make fun of other people. And that's why it intrigues me so much.
How important is image to you?
Image, well, I think I've always had sort of the same. I've always tried to look like a successful undertaker. That's the image I strive for.
Speaking with John Waters, what do you think of the movie Lust in the Dust was the first movie to have someone who you first work with, mm-hmm. Divine, teamed up with Tad Hunter. And it's a major motion picture release and all that. How did you feel seeing Divine in
very
a different context?
Interesting for
did
me.
Did you feel
to
like
see...
he was stolen away from
no,
you at all?
No, I know Paul and I know Tab. And, no, I thought it was. I was happy for Divine. Divine made a lot of money to be in that film, much more than he's ever made for me. And I've always told the people, I can give you this certain amount of fame, notoriety, whatever you want to call it. Take that and cash in on it some way. You know, so I was glad for Divine and Edie are the only two that really have ever done that. The actors, I'm saying. It was interesting for me to see Divine on the screen when somebody else was telling him what to do. I've never seen that before. I think Divine was the best thing in the movie.
Do you think he acts differently in that movie than in yours? Did you see different facets of him as an actor?
Well, it was certainly a different part. It was a different kind of script. I don't know. That's a good question. I saw some of the same expressions that I've certainly seen in my movies, and I could see him doing one thing and think, oh, that's how he looked in Female Drama, you know, that kind of thing.
Tab Hunter was the first actor who you worked with who was a product of the Hollywood studios. Did you have to change your style of directing for him? Was he used to what you do?
I don't know if he was used to it. He was certainly a good sport about it. He was didn't complain, didn't throw star fits. Actually, I think he had a good time making the movie. He was a joy to work with. We filmed all around him, so I could only afford him to have him there for 10 days. So we made every scene in the movie except his and did all his in 10 days. So, some days we worked 20 hours and he didn't complain, straight, without anything, which in Hollywood you don't do that. You know, you have people that say, okay, that's gold time, platinum time, which means triple your salary or something.
You've worked with a lot of non-actors. Do you think that there's special things that you can get out of non-actors?
Yeah, I've changed my mind in that in some ways. I like to work with a lot of real actors now, too. I like both put together. I don't want to make a movie anymore with all non-actors. I think there's a certain kind of innocence that works on film from somebody that is a non-actor. But then looking back on my films, there's some non-actors that are terrible. That when I look back on them now, I think give a bad performance. But I think I think you have to take chances. And I think when you take a chance, you'll get an Edie or somebody that can do something that no actress could learn to do Edie.
I like to think of you on the set. I've heard that, you know, no drugs or alcohol allowed on the set, yet the film's probably going to be all about that.
So you
don't allow that kind of thing to
intrude
into the work.
No, I'm really like a monster on the set. Not really a monster, but I'm really It has to be planned. Everybody has to be there on time. I run really tight. And I think I have to only because I have no money to make the movie. So if we don't have it rehearsed and we know exactly what we're going to do before we start shooting, we won't come in on budget. And I owe that to the people that give me the money to make movies, certainly. I think some actors probably would hate how I direct because I'm so used to working with non-actors that I act it out for them in rehearsal exactly how I want them to play it. I've done the entire movie with me playing every part almost. And many actors would hate that, I would imagine.
David Lothery, who's one of the people who appeared in a lot of your movies.
Lockery died
of a drug overdose. Was that?
Yeah, and that was something that David did not have a history of drug problems. I mean, he did drugs like everybody did in the 60s. And that happened late in life, and he got into it. And it happened very, very quickly. And it was horrible. I mean, it was a thing that you couldn't stop, and it happened so quickly, and it was so horrible that people could see it happening, but there was nothing you could do about it.
Did that change you? Did it make you think that you'd been
Well, I hadn't taken drugs for a long time before that anyway.
Uh-huh.
I mean, look, I'm not saying in the last 10 years I haven't ever not taken drugs, but I'm saying I don't think about it. I don't buy them. I don't take drugs. It reinforced everything I felt. It wasn't something new to think you shouldn't smoke angel dust. I knew you shouldn't. And it certainly depressed me. It made me very, very, at the time, it was just unbelievable to me. And I still, when I see those films, it's like now watching Ghosts. You know, I feel like I'm watching Topper. But at least I can see David still. He's in a film. I mean, where when other people die, you don't see their image that much. I feel that, you know, I still see David's image all the time.
Do people assume that you're going to be like characters in your movies?
I don't know anymore. Sometimes, but I think now, at first, people expected me. Now they maybe heard that I'm not like that, or they've seen me on television or something. But, yeah, in the colleges, they expect me when I pull up. God knows what they expect. They say, God, you're so different from what we thought. I don't know what they think, thank God. I don't know. It's very, I think from seeing the movies, for some reason they don't think that of other directors when they see their films. I think it's because those early films were made so cheaply that they look like documentaries almost. They're grainy and they look like I stumbled upon this somewhere in the woods, this horror show going on.
That's really true how cheap movies can look so real because they look like documentaries or home movies.
They look like the news.
Yeah.
And they were filmed on a camera like the news uses with the sound right on the film, the magnetic film.
One of the things that you're doing now is reporting.
Yeah.
You've done reports for All Things Considered. You've written reports for magazines.
Yeah.
What do you enjoy about that?
Well, I always have these interests that I'm a nosy person in the first place, which you have to be a reporter. If you want to be a good reporter, you have to be nosy. If you want to be a good director, you have to be bossy. So I'm a nosy, bossy person. So I used to go and cover these kind of things just for my own personal interest, and people think you're crazy. But if you do it for a magazine and get paid, then it's fine. So I might as well get paid to do what I enjoy doing anyway. Writing the movies has always been my favorite part anyway. So writing these articles is really an excuse to follow my interests. And generally the magazines so far, Rolling Stone and Lampoon, I have stuff in American Film, have gone for the things I'm interested in. I'm not interested in having an assignment given to me. Go write about the making of Baby 2, you know? but something that I'm really obsessed with anyway, it just gives me carte blanche to become more obsessed by it.
What were some of the things you used that to advantage for?
Well, I interviewed this guy on death row that got the electric chair, Arthur Good, who was somebody that was really frightening to me, a child molester, an unrepentant one who wanted Ricky Schroeder to sit nude on his lap in the electric chair. That was his last request. I did that when I did something for Rolling Stone, Why I Love the National Enquirer, American Film about teaching in jail. So the editors have gone for my ideas. Which is great. I mean, I haven't so far called up and said, I'd like to do this, and they all say, I don't know.
So it scared you to meet the guy who was the child molester? And
it didn't scare me because I'm not a child. You know, he wasn't. It scared me because I'm really against capital punishment, but listening to him, the world's not a worse place because they killed him. I think he wanted it. It was like suicide in a way. I mean, he was like Dawn Davenport in Female Trouble. He loved the attention it gave him. He had a big press conference the day he got the chair. But then it was very sad when they put him in the chair. They put his arms, strapped his arms in. He had a great line. It was, "Who will wipe away my tears?" Which is really, I think, almost a Tennessee Williams kind of line.
Who are now your favorite directors and writers?
Gee, I can't think of any right off. I mean, Fassbender was my favorite, and I really miss that he's not here because he made so many films. I was used to two or three a year.
You both like Douglas Sirk a lot, right?
Oh, yeah, I love Douglas Sirk. He's still alive, though. Gee, I'm trying to think of what movies I like. I like Godard still very much. I liked his last movie, First Name Carmen, I like this Bresson film, L'Argent, I like very much. I like this feminist film, what's it, A Question of Silence. Those are some off the top of my head that I've liked recently. I like The Breakfast Club. I even like some of these teenage movies, which I know is the genre you're really supposed to hate today.
Have you made any reconciliations or anything with your parents now that you're
I never had
well
a real split with them.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they've always supported me for what I did. I mean, there were times when they weren't real proud of what I did, and we've certainly had a lot of fights and everything, but I've always gotten along with them in a weird kind of way.
What do you think of the movie? Have you seen it yet? The movie about you?
I saw it in Italy, but just with Italian voiceovers out. It's almost impossible to watch a documentary about yourself. I feel like I'm in the coffin hearing these voices.
Have
especially when they say,
it?
Yeah, no, they haven't seen it. Because they never thought it was going to be shown here. They told me it was only going to be shown in Italy, and then it never showed in Italy because the films got banned and it's now showing here. It's very weird to see a documentary about yourself. I mean, it just makes you a little uncomfortable. It's the same way I don't have big pictures of myself in my apartment. You know, it's the same kind
of... I'm glad to hear it.
But some people do, believe
do
me.
Do they really?
I know people that have pictures of themselves all over their apartment. But it's the same kind of thing. It's just like kind of embarrassing. It's not a... Nobody says, and I don't think I look bad in it. I was worried that my parents would. I certainly don't want my parents to look buffoonish or something in a film.
Well,
it's just an odd experience.
Right. Well, you'll be seeing it tonight in English.
Yeah.
And
I don't know if I'm going to watch it or not.
Really?
Well, it's right before I come on. I always like to go over what I'm going to say before I'm sitting there watching. I'll hear it. I'll be backstage.
You can watch it later.
Yeah.
Okay. John Waters, thanks a lot for being
thanks
here today.
Thanks for having me.
John Waters has been my guest. He's a film director, screenwriter, and writer and reporter now as well. As a matter of fact, some of his reports have been broadcast on All Things Considered. And his movies include Pink Flamingos and Polyester, Female Trouble, Mondo Trasho, Desperate Living. His film Polyester, which is his most recent movie, will be screened today and tomorrow at the TLA on a double bill with a new film about him, an Italian-made documentary called Divine Waters. John Waters will be there at 9 o'clock tonight at the TLA, which is at 334 South Street. For more information, you can call 922-1010. John Waters continues to live in Baltimore. You think you'll be there much longer?
Oh, sure. I would have moved long ago if I was going to move.
Okay. Thanks again for being with us
today.
Okay,
thanks.
It's 2 minutes to 5. All Things Considered is coming up at 5 from National Public Radio. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air, but first, why don't we check in with Shadow Traffic?
Eastbound on the Schuylkill Expressway this afternoon is slow from approaching the Twin Bridges through the Strawberry Mansion Bridge due to an earlier multi-vehicle accident now cleared to the side. Also, eastbound is slow from Spring Garden through South Street, a 12-minute delay as you're heading home. Westbound is slow from the University Avenue off-ramp through South Street, a 12-minute delay as well. Southbound 95 is slow from the upstroke of the Girard Point Bridge through the Platte Detour Road at Island Avenue. Expect a 15-minute delay. Eastbound on the Kelly Drive this afternoon is slow from City Line through the Twin Bridges. You'll find northbound Chemical Road slow from the Blue Route through Germantown Pike. Also, westbound Route 30 is slow from Route 100 through Whitford Road, and eastbound on the Ben Franklin Bridge is slow from midspan through the Toll Plaza. That's Shadow Traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is Ray Koo.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by the Windsor Shirt Company. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll feature a National Press Club address by David Stockman, Director of the Office of Management and Budget. At 3:45, Bob Carlin hosts The Record Ranch. And at 4 o'clock, we expect to be joined by performer Peter Allen. So that's all coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's show. Ron Barron was the technical director, production assistance from Greg Allen. Maeve McGoran is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Danny Miller co-produces the show. My name is Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a very good evening. And I want to say that if you want to drop us a card or a letter, we hope you'll write at Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Well, stay tuned for All Things Considered, which is coming up next from National Public Radio. You're tuned to listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley, WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 5 o'clock.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Lynn Neary.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
lot of the people that I admire, King, Gandhi, Cervantes, spent time in jail. I'm a young man still, 41 years old. I think a year or two in jail would be a phase of my life, which I'm ready to pay.
Jack Elder was one of two sanctuary workers sentenced to jail today for illegally helping Salvadoran refugees. Why he's willing to serve time tonight on All Things Considered.
And these stories, the Supreme Court tightens restrictions on the use of deadly force.
South African President P.W. Botha says his country will not be brought to its knees.
Bernhard Goetz indicted on 4 counts of attempted murder.
The arts begin flourishing again in Argentina.
And gypsy jazz guitarist Borelli Lidgren.
First, this news.
This is Brian Naylor. A second grand jury investigating the subway shootings of 4 youths by Bernhard Goetz today indicted Goetz on 4 counts of attempted murder. From New York, John Kalish reports.
The grand jury indicted Goetz on 4 counts of attempted murder, 4 counts of assault, and 1 count of reckless endangerment. Goetz was also indicted for criminal possession of a weapon in the second degree, a more serious charge than the weapons indictments voted against Goetz by the first grand jury. Manhattan District Attorney Robert Morgenthau would not say how long the second grand jury deliberated, but he did say new evidence that was not presented to the first grand jury had a substantial impact on the second panel. Morgenthau told reporters this afternoon that the second grand jury apparently did not accept the claim by Goetz that the shooting was justified as an act of self-defense.
We are not present when the grand jury deliberates, but I think that's what you've got to conclude, because they were given a complete charge, a charge on justification, and the fact that they have come up with an attempted murder indictment means that they found no justification.
Goetz will plead not guilty on the new charges tomorrow. If convicted, he could face more than 40 years in prison. This is John Kalish in New York.
The Supreme Court handed down a major decision today on the use of deadly force. By a 6-3 vote, the justices ruled the use of deadly force to stop a suspected criminal is unconstitutional if the suspect appears to be unarmed. The decision came in a Tennessee case, and there are similar laws in about half the states. However, police departments in most major cities already have regulations in place that follow the court's ruling. In another case, the court deadlocked and so upheld a lower court ruling that a city may not ban the display of nativity scenes on public land simply by saying it unconstitutionally promotes religion. Due to the absence of Justice Lewis Powell during oral arguments, the court was evenly divided, 4-4, and therefore today's ruling does not set a national precedent. Pentagon officials acknowledged today that U.S. Army Major Arthur Nicholson was taking pictures of Soviet military equipment when he was shot by a Soviet guard on Sunday. The officials said Nicholson was in an area that had been off limits to American observers, but the restriction was lifted February 20th. They said the Soviets only had the right to detain Nicholson. The officials said high-level talks would be held to try to ensure there were no more shooting incidents, and at the White House today there was talk of other action. NPR's Jim Angle reports.
White House spokesman Larry Speake said today that the United States is considering some sort of diplomatic action against the Soviet Union in response to the shooting. Asked if the shooting had had any effect on other areas of U.S.-Soviet relations, Speake said we are considering some steps, but until they are finalized, he said he couldn't be more specific. I can't spell them out, Speake said, but there are a number of diplomatic-related steps we could take. Until today, the White House has taken a low profile in the whole dispute over the shooting. The day it was announced, President Reagan was asked if the incident would have any effect on the prospects for a summit meeting with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. The president said no, that he was more anxious than ever to meet with the Soviets. In the past, far less serious events have received far greater attention by the president and the White House, but previous disputes came during a period of very poor relations. White House spokesman Larry Speake said yesterday that the president's expression of increased interest in a summit, even while we are accusing the Soviets of murder, as one official put it, is an attempt to reduce tensions and prevent instances of this type. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
Education Secretary William Bennett today outlined his plans for education policy over the next 4 years. Bennett said that improvements in the 3 R's could be achieved by focusing on the 3 C's, content, character, and choice. NPR's Frank Stacio reports.
Content and character are educational issues, what to teach and how to do it. Bennett said schools should put more emphasis on Western culture and values. He told a luncheon audience at the National Press Club that education has become long on technique and short on tradition. It is the 3rd C, the C for choice, that has drawn the most fire. Bennett backs tuition tax credits and vouchers as ways of offering public support to parents who want to send their children to private schools. Critics say such incentives would undermine public education, but Bennett says giving parents a choice can only help public schools.
Developing such instruments of choice, whether at the federal or state level, will not lead to a mass exodus from our public schools. I believe that competition for these public schools that have been holding a captive audience will be one of the best catalysts to make some of them improve their performance.
Bennett said that if tax credit and voucher programs are designed, they should guarantee that families at all economic levels and not just the affluent will be able to benefit. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up over 5 points today, finishing at 1264.91. I'm Brian Naylor, National Public Radio in Washington.
The Supreme Court ruled today that police may not shoot unarmed suspects fleeing from the scene of a crime. In a 6-3 decision, the court said police may only shoot when the escaping suspect poses a serious threat of death or injury to police or others. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The Supreme Court's decision came in the case of Edward Garner, a 15-year-old black youngster who stood 5 feet 4 inches tall and weighed between 85 and 100 pounds. On October 3, 1974, Garner apparently broke into an unoccupied house in suburban Memphis, Tennessee. Neighbors called the police. Two officers arrived and spotted Garner in the backyard. They shone a flashlight on him, saw he was unarmed, ordered him to halt, and when the boy tried to climb the backyard fence to escape, police shot and killed him.